and tucked in the dollar bills she'd kept in a coffee can. They'd be ready, if it came to that. At dinner at noon and at supper at 6, he said only the things he might have said 2 days ago, before she'd ruined it all with her honesty. What had Ruth learned in school, he asked, and what had she sold at the stand? Were the late raspberries still coming in? And it had better not rain tomorrow. Amanda saw him smile at Ruth and at Rudy, but she avoided his gaze herself, keeping her eyes on the plates. But then, after supper, when they were all sitting in the front room, Ruth reading, Amanda mending, Rudy just sitting with his feet up on the hassock for half an hour, before shuffling out to his den over the garage, an unusual thing happened. "Why don't we ever play these?" Carl said, opening the cabinet under the phonograph. "Ugh, they're so old," Amanda protested, not looking up from the sock she was darning, but he paid no attention, and cranked the handle until suddenly Alexander's ragtime band came bouncing and tumbling into the room. And then, an even stranger thing, Amanda thought later. Afterward, she could hardly believe it, but it happened just the same. "Madam, may I have this dance?" He bowed formally and held out his hand. "Carl," she laughed uncomfortably, shaking her head. This was not what they did, how they were. What did he mean by it? Was he making fun? But he lifted her hand off the arm of the chair, and she let him pull her to her feet, let him steer her around the furniture, until she realized she was dancing just as much as he. "Pull that chair back, Ruth," she gasped, as she shrank against Carl to escape the smack of the newel post. When they saw that Rudy and Ruth were trying to polka to ragtime, they switched partners, so Carl could teach Ruth to turkey trot. "This is the dance your mother and I used to do," he said. They took turns choosing the records and winding the phonograph, until Rudy collapsed in a chair, fanning his craggy face with the Ladies' Home Journal, and Amanda, hearing the kitchen clock strike, remembered that Ruth had school the next day and must drink a glass of milk and go straight to bed. When the house was quiet, Amanda set out plates and bowls for breakfast the next morning, jigging a little as she moved around the table. In the front room, she found Carl tugging the Davenport back into place. "Here," she said, easily lifting her end and shrugging off the image of her mother frowning at her unladylike strength. Now that the odd dancing was over, she felt even more wary of Carl than before, but wrestling the furniture helped. "That was a good idea," she said, almost shyly, testing the waters. "We should have been doing that all along. Saturday nights, at least. We should have had some kids over for Ruth." "Maybe so," Amanda said, smoothing the antimacassar on the Davenport arm nearest her. She could feel the panic rise even at the suggestion. Didn't Ruth see enough of other children at school? "I decided something today," Carl said, seating himself in an armchair and scraping his still boyish hair back from his forehead with his fingers. "Now," Amanda thought, still pulling at the white embroidered edge, had it shrunk in the last washing? He would talk about Clement and Imogene. He would tell her how she'd have to pay. "I'm going to get a job." "What?" The antimacassar slid off the arm and fluttered to the floor. "My cousin Hilda's husband, he's first mate on one of those iron ships, he can get me a good place." "Oh, a good place. That's good, a good place," she heard herself saying. "You're right about us needing money," he continued. "I've been distracted and useless for too long here. It's time I got to work." "You're not useless, Carl." So they'd pretend that she'd admitted nothing, that he was only taking the practical measure she'd been suggesting for a year. He was making this easier than she ever could have hoped. He was letting her run away again, and this time she wouldn't even have to move. But that wasn't, she saw now, what she wanted. She was bone tired of all this running and hiding, of living alone with a monstrous hump of truth strapped to her back. Seeing him sitting there, one hand unconsciously rubbing the hole in his thigh that she knew had never quite closed, she forgot the hysterical regrets of the morning. She wanted now what she'd wanted the night before when he'd stood in the doorway, pointing at the clipping from her scrapbook, and she'd realized that through some silent, miraculous communication of their spirits, he'd come to understand her. Again tonight she ached to share with him the events that had pushed both their lives into such lonely paths. She would tell him everything, and then, please God, he would say it was all right. It hadn't been her fault. Matilda would forgive. She edged toward the abyss. "And that's the only reason you want to go, the money?" Why else? So he would make her say it first. All right, that was fair. She took a deep breath. She would go on. I thought, she said, staring bravely straight into his eyes, what I said about Clement Owens. He threw his head back in a sort of half laugh, rose and went to look out the open window. The weather had changed, Amanda noticed, newly aware of the cool current slipping in over the sill. Summer, worn out, had retreated in a matter of hours, and fall had marched triumphantly down from the north. The air was chilly, and the insects and the frogs, frenzied only the night before, were still. It was so long ago, he said to the dispassionate dark blue sky. Now I can't even remember what she looked like. That's awful, isn't it? I've tried, but I just can't, not really. Not more than a glint now and then. He turned toward her and said with touching earnestness, It's hard to know for sure from so far away, but I believe I did love her, and I think she loved me. But you see, I think she must have changed when I went away. I know she must have been lonely and angry with me, too. Yes, I know she was, he insisted when Amanda shook her head. She told me so, and she had every right to be, the way I joined up without even telling her, because I was scared she'd say no. What I think, he continued, and his words slowed as if he were deciphering a puzzle as he spoke, is that it wasn't really my Matilda who had his baby, but some other woman she became, some other woman I never knew. That's what I think. That's what I've decided, he said almost defiantly. Amanda felt as if she'd dropped into a bottomless pool and was sinking fast. Carl, no, she flailed. Maddie never... But she couldn't grab hold of the right words. He was sitting beside her then, and he caught the hand she was, without knowing it, beating against the cushion. Listen, Amanda, listen to me. I know it was my fault, in a way. I didn't have to go so quick like I did. I didn't have to jump at the chance. You were right those times you said I wanted to go. I thought it was the thing a man would do, and I wanted to show her, to show everyone, even myself, that I was a man. I didn't think about what it would mean, how I would get so far away and not be able to come back. He sighed and looked away. All I'm saying is that I know what it's like to do something, and then later, the reasons why you did it seem foolish. I know how things can change in ways you never meant, and I'm sure that Maddie would come back just like I did if she could, if the baby hadn't killed her. I know she would. Amanda sat stunned as much by her silence as by his misunderstanding. Why wasn't she telling him the truth? His face, closer than she was used to seeing it as he sat there beside her on the Davenport, looked different, as if it belonged to a stranger who only resembled him around the eyes. I realize what you've done for me and my daughter, he was saying. I know you gave up your nursing, that you worked so hard for. It's not every sister who would do that. And I know it's far more than I can ever hope to repay. But at least I'm going to do my part from now on. He'd not understood at all, she thought. There'd been no communication of the spirit, no seeing into her soul. And now she was letting him think Maddie, oh, poor Maddie, poor Carl. And along with pity and shame, she felt a trickle of outrage, shameful in itself, that she played only the most peripheral of parts in this version of events. Carl, she began. My daughter, he'd said, as if Ruth were his alone. We pay, he'd said, as if they were involved in some sort of transaction, as if she'd not lived every minute there with her Ruth for love. How tightly his fingers held the fragile bones of her wrist. Should they make her feel safe or terribly afraid? Say it, she told herself, say it. She put her hand on his to make him listen, and her scar smiled up at her. It wasn't your fault, she made herself say. It wasn't Matilda's fault. It was my fault. I let her go. Of course, that hadn't explained anything, Amanda admitted to herself the next week, after Carl had gone to Sheboygan to meet the Rebecca Ray. He'd only patted her, uncomprehending, and told her again how grateful he was to her for raising Ruth. And she'd been seized so violently by choking sobs, she'd been unable to go on. So it was worse now than ever before. She'd as good as lied now, letting him believe the worst about Maddie. Only her vow to reveal the entire truth the very next time the ship docked in Milwaukee comforted her enough so that she could fall asleep at night. Although with the reassurance of morning, she always recognized that promise as futile. In the meantime, Carl sent postcards from places like Gary and Duluth that Ruth hoarded in a box that had once held paper collars. "Where was it the last one was from?" Amanda would ask, deferring to Ruth when people inquired about Carl. And when she replied, "Sault Ste. Marie or Green Bay," they snapped their tongues against the roofs of their mouths and shook their heads. "That's a man likes to see the world," they'd say, as if turning circles around the Great Lakes was somehow exotic and suspect. Ruth hardly listened. She'd begun to realize that people always had to say something. Ruth kept her box of postcards in the house on the island. She liked to look at them there, where she didn't have to share them with Amanda, where the smell of his cigarettes lingered, and the crazy patches of light on the floor reminded her of how he'd peeled the boards from the windows. On a map, she located each city from which he'd sent a card and memorized the facades and the vegetation in the picture, believing, although she knew it was unreasonable, that if he didn't return, she'd somehow be able to trace him with such crumbs. Chapter 13. Amanda. People ask about my hand, not just Ruth, but people who have no business wondering. They point, they look aghast. It's amazing what people think they have a right to know. "What's that?" they say. "Is that a bite? Who bit you?" My hand could have been bitten at the hospital, back when I was treating those soldiers. You can't imagine how fierce people can be when they're crazy with fear, when they know they're going to die, and they believe you're an angel pushing them toward the grave. Carl never asked. I think he didn't want to know what could turn a person into an animal. "Hot enough for you?" Ray asked, passing Ruth one of the drinks he'd carried back to the table. "Mmm," she agreed. She took a tiny sip of the whiskey sour while he settled into a chair. She nodded and kept her smile fixed. She could think of nothing to say. "Certainly is hot," she said finally. He beamed, grateful. "Certainly is." He stood as Imogene approached the table. "Hot enough for you?" "Never," Imogene said, and she grabbed his hand and pulled him toward the dance floor with a shimmy, as a private wave rolled off her fingertips toward Ruth. Ruth and Imogene had gone dancing every Friday night since the new dance pavilion opened that June of 1937. The pavilion was a platform at the edge of the lake, and when the band was playing, the water carried the music for miles. The summer people, who had cottages or mansions along the lake, depending not so much upon what they could afford, but on their idea of what a summer place should be, came to the dances by boat. But Imogene and Ruth, who were lifers, as Imogene said, came in the Lindgren's Ford. "You know you've got a big run up the back of your leg. You better go back in and change," Imogene had said that evening when she picked Ruth up. But Ruth didn't have another presentable stocking. And so the two of them sat there for a minute, examining the run, trying to decide if it was really all that noticeable. Ruth twisted it a bit to get a better look, and then, zip, of course, it went all the way up and spread out a bit, too. She pulled the stockings off, she hated the hot things anyway, and tossed them into the back seat. She rolled the window down as far as it would go and felt the breeze on her skin as they drove. It was hot. Ray was right, if unoriginal. And the velvety, humid air of the dance pavilion was drenched in scent, smoke and cheap fruity perfume, lipstick, shampoo, and sweat layered over honeysuckle, grass, and gasoline fumes rising from the boat's motors. Ruth's bare legs, which had felt almost racy in the car, now made her self-conscious. When they were crossed, a slick of sweat formed between the top of one thigh and the underside of the other. She tried to keep them beneath the table as much as possible. These occasions were a trial for her, even though she knew she ought to enjoy them the way everyone else did. The new pavilion was all anyone talked about at Brown's Business College, and though Ruth had dreaded it from the moment she first heard the idea, Imogene made it clear she'd have to go. "Of course you'll go," Imogene had been taking mental inventory of her dresses, trying to determine whether she needed to petition her parents for something new. "Think of the possibilities, Ruth. Everyone will be there. Bobby Hanser and Harold Koch and all those summer people? Bobby Hanser and Harold Koch were a couple of the boys Imogene talked to sometimes when they came into the shop before a day of fishing. But they were definitely not, she explained to Ruth, the fishing type. They're sailors, she said proudly. Members of the yacht club. They were talking about racing their A-boats, and they have ice boats, too, I bet. What's an A-boat? The big ones, I think, I'm pretty sure. Imogene and Ruth had often admired those grand boats when they flocked on Sunday afternoons. They strung out in the fresh wind to cover almost the whole of the lake, pushing the smaller boats, the fishermen and dinghy sailors, to the edges. I'd like to ride on one of those, Ruth often said, and Imogene, who appreciated not only their grace, but the gracious leisure they implied, agreed. From the shore, they gazed through Amanda's binoculars, keeping track of their favorite boats by the numbers on their sails. Imogene liked V7, whose deck was sky blue, although she rooted loyally for Bobby's yellow one as well. But Ruth preferred a seafoam green boat. That's Arthur Owens, Imogene said, and through the binoculars Ruth could see, when he turned his head, the string that would keep his glasses from falling into the lake. So that Imogene could get to know Bobby and Harold and their friends better, maybe even go with one of them, maybe even marry one, who knew, Ruth, every Friday for the last 4 weeks, had put on her good dress, the one Aunt Mandy had made for her 3 years ago. Aunt Mandy disapproved of the dances. "Why do you want to talk to all those strange boys?" she'd asked that evening from the bathroom doorway. "I know your father wouldn't like it." Ruth had climbed onto the toilet cover to see as much of herself as possible in the mirror over the sink. "All right," she said to Amanda as she stepped back to the floor with a heavy thump. "I won't talk." She began to arrange her hair, but when the comb caught in a knot and slipped from her fingers, she sighed, exasperated. "I'm only going for Imogene anyway." "Here, let me." Amanda picked up the comb and used it deftly to twist Ruth's hair this way and that. She pinned it roughly, not taking care to avoid Ruth's scalp, but the effect was nice. "Such beautiful hair," Amanda said, "just like your mother's. Aren't you glad you listened to me and didn't cut it just because of some silly fashion?" Aunt Mandy didn't need to worry about strange boys, Ruth thought now, savoring the sweet and sour tingle of her drink. Boys and girls both were interested in talking only to Imogene. They pulled her away from Ruth as soon as the two of them walked in, and hung on her words, the back feet of their chairs poised inches above the wooden floor, as they leaned toward her, offering lighted matches, pink punch, scraps of gossip, whispering, "Did you hear?" and "Did you get a look?" glancing furtively over their shoulders at the objects of their stories. Ruth leaned back in her own chair with her sweating glass and her fixed smile, and listened as well as she could to the music. When Bobby Hanser suddenly appeared, Ruth watched Imogene pretend to be surprised, pretend to need coaxing, and finally take his hand and, with practiced skill, lead him to the very center of the floor. Amanda was wrong. Her father would like this place, Ruth thought, watching Imogene and Bobby foxtrot, and remembering the happy night of the phonograph, although there'd been no more of that in the short weeks when he came home, while the Rebecca Ray was docked in Milwaukee or Chicago. If her mother were alive, he'd want to take her dancing. It would be nice, Ruth thought, with a little pain in her throat, if someone wanted to take her like that. But she tossed her head. Who, anyway, did she want as a beau? Certainly none of these. It occurred to her then, as it usually did about this time, that she could make a trip to the ladies' room. No one would notice if she disappeared for a little while. She made her way between the tables and around the dance floor, dodging elbows, saying, "Excuse me," and "Pardon me," and when bodies would not notice and did not budge, turning herself sideways to squeeze between them. A girl pealed sudden laughter into her ear. A man stepped back, grinding his heel into her toe. Gauzy dresses swirled, necks were damp with sweat, the music and the voices tangled exuberantly. Ruth pushed open the door marked Doze and slipped inside. In the cool and nearly quiet room, Ruth went directly to the little bench, padded in shiny pink fabric, that was pushed against one wall under the windows, convenient for any female who might feel a bit faint and require a quiet spot to recover. She kicked off her shoes, tucked her feet under her, and pulled a novel from her handbag. She would finish this chapter, no more, and then go back out and keep up appearances. She'd only read a paragraph when the door burst open, admitting a torrent of noise and two girls Ruth knew by sight, as members of Bobby Hanser's set. They gave Ruth barely a glance before one went into a stall, and the other leaned over the sink so that her face was only inches from the mirror, and pushed her hair off her forehead to get a close look at her skin. She frowned at her reflection. "She's a forward little thing, isn't she?" the girl in the stall said over the sound of streaming water. "I don't know, Zita. He asked her to dance, is what I saw." "Well, that's what she wants you to see. I know her type." After a moment, she added, "You can smell it on her. Did you notice?"
"Smell what?"
"Oh, de grub." "I'll take your word for it," said the other girl. She opened a compact and dusted some powder over her cheeks. "It's too bad we can't bottle it, sell it to the locals." "Bobby seems to like it." The toilet flushed and Zita emerged and joined her friend at the sink. "Oh, you know Bobby and his summer flings. When it's hot, he likes anything in a skirt. He was going on the other day about how cute she was in her little apron, pulling worms out of the dirt by their tails. Isn't that the limit?" As she washed her hands, she leaned toward the mirror and bared her teeth. "Oh, he's fickle, all right. I should know." The other girl crossed her arms. "Where do I put this?" Zita said, holding up the towel she'd used to dry her hands. "Well, give it to her, I guess," her friend said, tilting her head at Ruth as she started out. Working her way back to her table, Ruth found herself pushed toward the edge of the room until she was almost squashed against the screen that ran all the way around the pavilion to discourage mosquitoes. Below, the waves washed against the pilings with a rhythm as steady as breathing. She looked out across the dark water and longed for her father to be there, skimming along the slick of moonlight in the rowboat, his arms pulling, his head turning to look over his shoulder to gauge his distance. He wouldn't care about all these other people. He would be coming just for her. When Ruth turned back, she realized with a start that Arthur Owens was looking at her from across the floor. It wasn't nice of him to notice her like that, adrift and obviously alone, obviously uninteresting to everyone else in the room. When had she begun to care about things like that, she asked herself angrily, frowning at Arthur. He was leaning against the railing, talking to the two girls she'd seen in the ladies' room. What had they told him about her? Quickly, she pressed on toward her table. Imogene and Ray were trying a dance in which he spun her right and then left while she stepped together, step, step, step together backward. It was something they'd seen Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers doing, but it turned out to be harder than it looked. Ruth observed that now Imogene had caught Arthur's attention, although he tried to concentrate on his conversation. She saw him laugh and nod, but continued to glance whenever he could in Imogene's direction. Ruth, safe in her seat again, examined him as carefully as she could without being obvious. Imogene would want to know every detail. One of the women he'd been talking to, the one who'd given Ruth her towel, stepped forward suddenly, grabbing his hand to pull him onto the floor. He was just reaching to set his glass on the rail to follow her when Ray spun Imogene so that she careened full force into his outstretched arm. Everyone looked dazed for a moment, and then there was a flurry of napkins. Imogene and Arthur and Ray were laughing. The woman who had intended to dance looked less pleased. Ruth, who'd been watching all of this as if it were a play, was a little flustered when she realized that Imogene was leading the entire group toward her table. "This is Bobby," Imogene announced to the table at large, "and this is his cousin Tom, and Zita and Kitty, and this is Arthur," she said, her hand on his arm. And then, beginning with Ruth, she named everyone at the table. "Now we've all been formally introduced." Arthur smiled at Ruth, and she blushed. Did he know she'd been studying him? "Would you believe I shot a 76 out there today?" Bobby announced to the table at large as he sat down. Several of the others acted suitably impressed and began to offer their best games for comparison. Ruth was not surprised, however, that Imogene soon dominated the table, although she'd never set foot on a golf course. Then Ray danced with Zita, and Arthur danced with Imogene. "Now you'll want to dance with Ruth," Imogene, fanning her face with both hands, announced to Arthur when they returned to the table. No, let's go out on the boat, Bobby said. One dance, Arthur said, and he held his hand out to Ruth. Ruth would rather not have danced, and she made a face at Imogene over her shoulder as Arthur led her to the floor. After all, if he'd wanted to dance with her, he would have asked her himself. But Imogene was already telling Tom one of her stories, sweeping her hands through the air so that her bangles jingled, tipping her head so that her rippling curls brushed her shoulders. Ruth gave up and turned to face her partner. "Hot, isn't it?" she said. Arthur was easy, relaxed. He held out his hand to her. He smiled. He looked at her through his round glasses as if she were the one he wanted from the start. It was only a foxtrot, but Ruth couldn't get the hang of the music. She tried to touch him lightly, to rest her hand soft as a moth on his shoulder, but she couldn't quite match his rhythm, and she had to cling to him, heavy and awkward, as he flung her to and fro, her hair loosening alarmingly with every jolt. But then something happened. Maybe it was only that the heat and the drink overwhelmed her at last. She was still clinging to him, but now she moved with him, flexible, smooth as oil. She let him draw her close until they fitted together. She let him steer her and forgot herself. She spun and threw her head back and watched the ceiling turn. She listened to the music and let her feet jump and slide whenever they pleased. And her smile was not fixed. When the dance was over and he led her back to the table, Ruth looked around in confusion. She couldn't remember which chair had been hers or where she left her bag. Bobby rose, pushing his chair back with his knees. How about that spin in the Chris-Craft now? We'll have to keep the speed down in the dark, but it's still a good ride. They herded down to the pier, jostling and jabbering, uncowed by the Milky Way and the expanse of restless black water. Their voices carried from one end of the lake to the other, as if in a massive theater. Ruth watched Imogene climb gracefully into the boat and copied as best she could the way Imogene used first Arthur's hand to steady her on the dock and then Bobby's shoulder to keep her footing in the boat. She scowled as she nearly twisted her ankle on the final step, feeling ridiculous in her heels. "Careful there," Arthur said. It never helped, Ruth thought with irritation, to be told to be careful after you'd tripped. Her right hand, the one he'd held as he helped her onto the boat, was trembling, and she squeezed it in the other. Almost before they'd found seats, Bobby gunned the engine, and they shot away from the lights of the pavilion. Suddenly he swerved, and Ruth had to grab Tom's arm to keep her seat. He swerved the other way, and she nearly flew into Imogene's lap. Between shrieks of laughter, Kitty and Zita shouted at him to slow down, but he only smiled and swerved again, this time pitching Arthur onto the floor and Imogene on top of him. Finally, Bobby tired of this game and slowed the engine. From a little mahogany cupboard beneath the bow, he produced a bottle of whiskey and glasses. Ruth glanced at Imogene, who was smoothing her skirt back over her knees as she leaned calmly against the cushions, and she felt almost sorry for those girls with their smug cracks about the bait shop. There wasn't a whiff of eau de grub about Imogene. Obviously, this was her natural element. She'd been born to listen to the rich rumble of the engine, to stroke the sleek varnished wood with her polished fingertips, to hold out her shapely hand, adorned with a tasteful slim ring her parents had given her to mark her high school graduation, for a crystal glass. "Let's lie down and stare at the stars," Zita announced, sinking to the floor of the boat. She lay on her back with one knee bent, so anyone could see the smooth stretch of her thigh. Ruth looked away, embarrassed for her. "Come on, get up, Zita," Bobby said, offering her his hand, but she batted it away. "Wait, I can hear the water," she announced, pressing her ear against the floorboards. She sat up suddenly, grabbed Ruth's hand, and tried to pull her down beside her. "Listen, turn off the engine, Bobby." Bobby did as he was told, and after a moment's struggle to stay in her seat, Ruth gave up and lowered herself to the floor. "Listen," Zita commanded, and Ruth tensely pressed her ear to the wood. Through the polished floorboard she could hear the water, slapping and sucking, worrying the wooden hull, trying to get in. Above her, Kitty's voice rang. "Know what I heard about that place?" Her ear still full of the suck and slap, suck and slap. Ruth watched Kitty point over the water. "Some woman drowned her baby on that island during the war. You're supposed to be able to hear it crying late at night. Is that true? She looked at Imogene, then down at Ruth. You ever hear it?
No, Ruth sat up abruptly.
Of course not, that's crazy. But she could hear a baby crying in her mind even now, the thin wail that grew more and more distant but never disappeared. She closed her eyes to shut out the sound, but it persisted, and though her ear was no longer against the floor, she could hear the lake, too, mingled with the crying, and she could feel the water, its wet tongue in her ears, in her eyes, embracing her, pulling her down. She opened her eyes, but the stars raced toward her, and she felt as if she were spinning uncontrollably through space. Her insides rose to her throat in a wave. She scrambled onto the seat and was sick over the side. Everyone was extremely kind.
It's the heat, Kitty said. I feel a little green myself.
It's because Bobby was bouncing us around, Zita said. I told you not to drive like that.
Well, you shouldn't make people lie in the bottom of the boat, Bobby said.
You're right, Zita said. I'm sorry, Ruth. Ruth took the hanky Imogene offered and blew her nose.
I'm all right now. I guess I'm just not used to so much to drink.
If Bobby didn't serve such cheap stuff, Arthur said, this kind of thing wouldn't happen. I got sick last week on his gin.
Ruth tried to smile at him, but her lips trembled and her arms were shaking so much she had to cross them over her chest to hold them still.
You're cold, Arthur exclaimed. Hasn't anyone got a jacket?
He went to the bow and returned with a towel left over from that afternoon swimming.
Come up front with me, why don't you? He said, gently draping the towel over her shoulders. The air's fresher away from the motor.
You'll let me drive for a while, won't you, Bobby?
Sure, Bobby said, settling into a back seat between Zita and Imogene.
Take it around by your place. Let's see if anyone's up.
Arthur started the engine and turned on the running lights with a twist of the silver knob. The inboard began its soothing blub-blub-blub, but Ruth still shivered. In every direction the water rippled like black crepe. If she dove in here, could she make it to shore?
So how long have you been coming out here? She asked to calm herself.
Oh, years, he said. The first time was just a few days after the war ended. I must have been about 5, and my dad brought me out when he was thinking of buying the land. That was when he planned to raise geese on it, you know, for feather beds. He thought they'd like being close to water, Arthur chuckled. He always has these crazy schemes.
But then he built a house instead.
Well, not instead, exactly. We did have the geese, and after that, racing pigeons, and then goats, until he converted the shed into a photography studio. He thought he had a quick way to develop film, but it didn't work out. Gave everybody a doppelganger. At the moment, he's revolutionizing the ice boat. He pronounced revolutionizing in a mocking tone.
So you don't think much of his ideas?
Oh, no, they're good ideas. He's bursting with good ideas. It's just that bursting makes a mess, and somehow he's never around when it comes time to clean up.
I've seen you in town before, he went on after a moment or two, with your mother.
That's my aunt. My mother died years ago.
And then somehow she felt like telling him more, maybe because he'd said so much about his father. She drowned, actually. She fell through the ice.
Here, on this lake. Arthur stared at Ruth, remembering the stinging gusts of a long-ago winter day.
Now over here. Now just from here to there, his father said, positioning 5-year-old Arthur. And Arthur stood and stood, inhaling the smell of wet wool as his scarf trapped the clouds of his breath. He was proud to be helping, although his feet were freezing and his fingers numb. He held one end of a piece of string, while his father paced deliberately around the property with the other end, and stopped now and then to record numbers in his little book. Finally, he said, "Enough. You can play now. I'm just going to the car for a minute." The ice was on the lake, a black sheet of it, lightly sugared with snow, upon which ice boats swooped and darted in the whipping wind, capricious as summer butterflies. Arthur hadn't been able to take his eyes off the frozen lake all the time he was standing holding his string. It was fascinating. It tempted him to walk on water. Released from his duties, Arthur stepped onto the lake. His right boot slipped immediately, but he caught his balance and shuffled forward a few steps toward a cluster of fishing shanties hunched against the cold. How deep the ice seemed to go. So deep he couldn't see where the frozen part ended and the water beneath it began.
He fell on his knees for a closer look and bent forward, his mittened hands splayed in front of him, his nose almost touching the lake. He studied the ice, the bubbles and fissures, the occasional leaf or frond of seaweed suspended in it, the clear patches that seemed to go down and down forever. Where were the fish? He crawled forward on his knees with no notion of where he was going, drawn on by the ice itself. A rumbling warned him that an ice boat was coming close, and he looked up to see it hurtling toward the shore. Just when he was sure it would crash full speed into the rocks, it spun around, runners scraping, sail luffing, until, voom, it caught the air and shot toward the middle of the lake again. As it flew past, two masked faces turned toward Arthur, and a hand in a three-fingered glove rose stiffly in greeting. Arthur waved and chased them for a few yards. When one of his feet slid, he looked down instinctively, throwing his hands out to break his fall. If the lady had not been entombed in ice, he would have landed in her arms. He saw first the swollen gray hand, and then the arm, the purplish fabric in folds, and finally the face. It was turned toward him, the blue eyes staring, the mouth open, screaming without sound, trapped in that bottomless black hole. He tried to get away, tried to rise and run, but his feet slipped and he fell back in the same spot, as if the hand had grabbed his boot and pulled him down. He managed to slide forward, finally, by staying on his knees and crawling, and in that manner he made his way as fast as he could to the shore. Once his feet were on solid ground, Arthur began to scream, and he ran up the hill toward the car, screaming every second he wasn't drawing breath. When his father snatched him up, Arthur buried his head in his huge shoulder, trying to blot out the face that was calling him from under the ice. "What?" his father asked, first alarmed, then soothing, then irritated. "Did you fall? Did you bang your head? Are you hurt? What? What in the hell's the matter with you?" Arthur pressed his eyes until they ached against his father's collarbone, and finally he managed to point without looking back toward the water. Arthur's father put him down, and they walked to the edge of the ice. There Arthur stopped, and when his father took his hand to draw him on, leaned back with all of his weight. "All right, stay here then," his father said impatiently. "Don't move, I'll be back in a moment." Arthur watched his father, arms slightly raised, shuffle and slide along the ice, following the trail Arthur's knees had left in the light snow. He saw him stop, reel back, catch himself, and then lower himself slowly to his knees. He saw him brush at the powder with his glove. Then he stood up again and made his way back. "How did the lady get in the ice?" Arthur asked when his hand was safely within his father's again, and they were trudging up the hill toward the car. "I don't know." "Shouldn't we get her out?" "The sheriff will do that, Arthur." The sheriff came out of his house with a napkin tucked into his trousers. He leaned into the car and winked at Arthur. "You take the boy home now," he said as Arthur's father got back in the car. "We know who it is. We'll find her." So they left the lady in the ice. "That's it," Arthur said, pulling back on the throttle before a wide lawn, gray under the night sky, that ran steeply up to a white house fronted with looming pillars. "Lovely," Imogene breathed, pretending, Ruth noticed, that she hadn't often stared from a rowboat at that facade and speculated about the lives inside. "When are you going to have another party, Arthur?" Zita asked. She stepped onto the seat behind Arthur as if to get a better look, and rested her hands on his shoulders for balance. "The one you had last summer was the best of the season. Don't you remember, Kitty? Swimming in the afternoon, and then the dance floor over by the boathouse. And Tom, remember when Eddie pushed you off the pier?" She laughed somewhat more wildly than the memory warranted. "Oh, Arthur, you have to promise me you'll have another," she said. "You must, or the whole summer will be wasted." She leaned close so that her sculpted hair brushed his cheek. "You promise?" "Anyone ever tell you there's a depression on?" he said, tipping his head toward hers. "Well, then, we need something to cheer us up." "Say, are we going to sit here all night?" Bobby said. "Let me take the wheel." And so they rearranged themselves, Bobby and Zita taking the seats up front, Imogene, with a lift of her eyes and a slight shift of her skirt, inviting Arthur into the place that Bobby had given up, and Ruth sliding in next to Ray. Kitty and Tom, who'd begun whispering to each other, stayed together in the back. "Not so hot out here," Ray said. "No," she smiled at him, "good old Ray. It's not bad out here at all." Bobby pushed the throttle forward suddenly then, and they raced smoothly through the black water, following their own tiny white beam. Greedily, Ruth leaned into the rushing warm air. Amanda. I was digging a few onions out of the garden, squatting in the dirt somewhat awkwardly because I couldn't bend, when what I assumed was an acorn dropped on my shoulder. "Hey," I said, looking into the trees. Another one bounced off my arm. When it rolled into the dirt, I saw it wasn't an acorn, but a marble. "Inside," Maddie hissed from a window. "Quick!"
"What is it?"
"Shh, Rudy," she mouthed. Quickly, I scanned the water. Yes, there he was. His back was to us as he rowed, but only a couple more pulls on the oars and he'd be dragging the boat onto our beach. The screen door slammed and Matilda, with Ruth glued to her hip, hurried down to the water. Keeping as low as I could, I scuttled for the back door. I watched from one of the front windows as they talked, watched Rudy throw Ruth into the air a few times, saw him heft a couple of filled burlap sacks from the boat. When he started carrying one of them toward the house, I bolted. I ran out the back door again and locked myself in the outhouse. If over the last month I'd forgotten that my situation was a shameful one, I couldn't help but remember it now as I breathed that stink and peered at the back of the house through the moon-shaped cutout in the door. I didn't come out until I saw Maddie, obviously searching for me. She grabbed my arm and shook me.
"You scared me half to death, Mandy. I was afraid you might have gone in the lake."
That night, for the first time in the season, the wind shifted to the east and the temperature dropped. I tucked wool blankets around Maddie and Ruth and then spread one on my own bed. It felt heavy after the summer of cotton and sheets. After I got under it, it seemed to pin my arms and legs to the bed and press me into sleep. At Brown's Business College, Ruth and Imogene learned to write shorthand and work the machines. Imogene was good at these things. In 2 weeks, she could type without looking at her fingers. In 4 weeks, she could take a 2-page letter from dictation without faltering. And, of course, the accounting was simple from the start. The assignments she turned in were always neat, the white pages clean and unwrinkled, the ink unsmudged. Ruth, on the other hand, was foundering. Imogene had convinced her that secretarial skills were important, but she missed the job she'd given up at the Five and Dime. She couldn't seem to type 2 lines before her mind wandered or her fingers disobeyed and punched the wrong keys. It was impossible to remember how many spaces went between the return address and the date and the internal address and the greeting, and who cared, who cared, who cared, she thought, tugging at a paper the typewriter refused to release. When she got behind in typing, she kept up with the rhythm of the class by hitting any old keys. While she was supposed to be taking letters about how much Mr. P owed to Mr. Q and in what increments he intended to pay, she sketched tiny figures wearing complicated hats in the margins of her paper. Imogene agreed that some of them turned out rather well. "Don't worry," she said, leaning over to correct Ruth's shorthand when the Browns were distracted. "You're the creative type." Imogene had decided that she and Ruth were going to be modern women. When they finished school, they would open an advertising agency together in Chicago. She would see to the business side and decide on the angles. She knew what made people want things. Ruth would do the art and write the copy. Imogene was not sure how they would get commissions, but she had vague notions of businessmen in gray suits and horn-rimmed glasses, raising their eyebrows in admiration at the originality and style and sheer selling power of their sample ads. Ruth suspected that Imogene had seen this in a movie. The idea made her anxious, but if Imogene wanted it, she was willing to do her part. She practiced her drawing, experimenting with different techniques she saw in the magazines. She did pen and ink renderings of ladies' shoes, and watercolors of fruit, and charcoal sketches of families frolicking by the seashore under enormous beach umbrellas cut from brightly colored paper. She liked to imagine the apartment they would have together in the city, where friends would stand in the street under their window and whistle for them to open the door. They would shop for groceries on their way home from their office, and they would sing along with the radio while they made chicken cacciatore and salads with tiny mushrooms. "I'm wrecked, absolutely wrecked," Imogene announced when class was dismissed for lunch that Monday. "I'll never be able to wear those shoes again." She flexed her pretty ankles before swinging her feet under one of the tables pushed beneath the windows in the typing hall.
"What did you do this weekend?" asked Lillian. She knew what was expected of her. Ruth and Imogene often ate lunch with Lillian and Myrtle, two sisters from Baraboo.
"We went to one of those dances, you know, over at the pavilion."
"Oh, a dance," Myrtle winked in a knowing way that Ruth disliked. Myrtle was older than the rest of them and divorced. She was always hinting at something dirty.
"Anyone interesting there?"
"No," Ruth said quickly.
"Yes," Imogene said. "Ruth met someone interesting."
"You don't say. What was he like, Ruth?"
Lillian leaned so eagerly over the table that some of the egg salad dropped out of her sandwich. Ruth was trying to finish her homework for that afternoon, two pages of shorthand she'd neglected over the weekend.
"He wasn't anything special, Lillian. He liked the way Jeannie danced, but who doesn't?"
"When are you going to let me do something with your hair, Ruth?" Myrtle asked, offering cigarettes around before lighting her own. "Men would like the way you dance, too, if you didn't look like an old-fashioned schoolmarm."
"Myrtle can do hair, Ruth," Lillian said. "She does mine, you know, the cut and the wave."
She turned to show off the back.
"And the color," Myrtle added. "Under that henna, Lillian's got hair like a mouse."
"It's true, I do."
There was something of the little girl with the black tooth in the way Ruth looked at the sisters then, as if they were the oddities and not she. But now she smiled, as she would never have done before. After all, they were only trying to help.
"My aunt likes it this way," she said. "It doesn't bother me."
The office door at the back of the room opened, and young Mr. Brown, the typing teacher, stepped out and strolled slowly through the classroom, with his hands in the pockets of his smartly cut trousers. He was known as young Mr. Brown, to distinguish him from his father, the school's founder, but he was hardly young by Imogene and Ruth's standards. He'd had ambitions once, and pursued them to Milwaukee, but had been somehow disappointed. He combed his hair back to show its curl to advantage, and kept his nails manicured. While other teachers rolled up their shirt sleeves and smudged chalk on their ties, no one could imagine young Mr. Brown shedding his jacket during the school day. Imogene said that was because he couldn't bear to be separated from the flask in the pocket.
"How are my girls?" he asked,
resting one hand on Imogene's shoulder, the other on Ruth's, and leaning between them to put his face next to theirs. He took a paternal stance toward his female students as an excuse to touch them and to stroke their hair. Ruth twitched almost involuntarily like a horse with a fly on its neck. She closed her notebook and studied its cover, waiting for him to move on. Imogene, though, looked him full in the face and nodded briskly. "Ruth needs to finish her work," she said. "Was there something you wanted?" Mr. Brown straightened his back.
"No, no," he said. "I'm off for my coffee break."
He removed his hand from Imogene's shoulder and, to compensate, gave Ruth's a little squeeze. Imogene rolled her eyes at his retreating back. "Coffee, I'll bet." She turned her attention back to the table.
"I wonder if Arthur Owens will be at the dance this week. Did he say anything about it to you, Ruth?"
"I already told you everything he said to me," Ruth answered without looking up. She slid her notebook in front of Imogene. "Show me how to do O-U-G-H again. I can never remember."
"You could remember if you tried," Imogene said impatiently, but she took the pencil Ruth held out to her.
The woman who stepped into the room just then wore a cinnamon-colored suit and a hat that wasn't the usual cloche, but a new style with a feather, angled to half-hide her face.
"Would you please tell me where I could find Mr. Brown?"
"Young Mr. Brown or old Mr. Brown?" Lillian piped up.
The woman hesitated.
"I don't know. I want to hire a secretary."
"Then you'll want to see old Mr. Brown," Imogene said. She was already on her feet.
"I'd be happy to show you to his office."
"Did you see her shoes?" Imogene whispered as she slid back into her seat. When the woman emerged from the office, she glanced toward the table and raised her hand to Imogene, who waved back.
"What did you say to her?" Ruth asked.
"Oh, I don't know," Imogene shrugged. "Just something about how much I've learned here."
"But you're only in level 2, Lillian protested.
"I type faster than most of the people in level 4. Besides, she wants someone gracious and sensible to answer her telephone and make appointments and keep her schedule in order."
"I'd be good at that, wouldn't I, Ruth?"
Gracious and sensible, Ruth thought. Those weren't Imogene's words, but they did describe her, part of her anyway. Mr. Brown came out of his office with a notice and tacked it to the board. Help wanted. personal secretary. Typing, filing, some dictation. Must have good telephone manners. No experience necessary. Teresa Owens, parenthesis, Mrs. Clement. W290N3040 Lakeside Road.
Chapter 14. Ruth, I've got to get you in that house. Imogene had stopped to see Ruth and Amanda on her way home from her first day at work at the Owenses. Are you riding your bicycle tonight? Amanda asked. It'll be raining in an hour. Oh, no, my parents let me take the Ford. I thought it would make a better impression. But let me tell you about this place. She pulled Ruth down beside her at the kitchen table and described the rooms Mrs. Owens had shown her that afternoon, sketching their positions with her finger on the oilcloth and recalling as well as she could the colors and fabrics and furnishings. Two fireplaces. What a waste, Amanda said. What's the use of two fireplaces? Well, it's a big room. There's one at either end, you see, so you can just use half the room for an intimate evening or the whole thing for a grand party. And she calls it the living room. Don't you think that's a much better term? So much more, I don't know, lively than front room. Of course, the whole house is quite rustic compared with their house in town. Of course, Amanda said dryly. Imogene, Ruth tells me you've quit Brown's to do this job. I thought you girls were working toward something better than typing some woman's letters. I thought you were going to be advertisers. She held a plate of coffee cake in front of each of them in turn. Ruth started to take a piece, but Imogene stopped her with a hand on her wrist. Wait, Ruth, try this. From her pocketbook, she pulled a smashed triangle of layer cake wrapped in her hanky. I smuggled it out for you. Isn't it scrumptious? Mocha. She pronounced the word carefully. The Owens's cook is from Austria. Did you know Austrians make the best pastry? I'm learning so much from Mrs. Owens. She's the president of all sorts of committees. She's even on the board at that hospital you used to work at, Miss Starkey. Ruth, you'll never guess what we had for dinner. What, lunch, I mean. Cucumber sandwiches with the crust cut off and iced tea with a sprig of mint in it. It tasted so fresh that way. Mrs. Owens says you must grow a patch of mint near your house for iced tea. And you know what she put on the plate? Just for decoration, although you could eat them. Wild strawberries. You know, those adorable tiny ones. Garnish makes the plate. That's what Mrs. Owens says. What's the point of putting something on your plate that you're not going to eat? Ruth asked. Amanda breathed deeply to steady her voice. So where was Mr. Owens while you were touring his house? Oh, he's up in Door County, doing something with ships, I believe. Arthur went with him, Imogene added for Ruth's benefit. The Rebecca Ray, Amanda recalled with relief, was headed for Duluth, nowhere near Door County. Well, Imogene, she said, it all sounds very exciting, but hadn't you better be running along? She forced herself to smile. We don't want your mother to think we've kidnapped you. It went on like this week after week. Imogene modeling a hand-me-down cashmere sweater Mrs. Owens had given her, choosing new stockings to match her employer's shade, and speaking with an inflection she'd never used before. Once, when Ruth wasn't at home, Imogene left a note for her. The message was not written in her usual compact, slanted script. Instead, the words were up and down, full of curves and loops and fat, round letters. The girl is possessed, Amanda thought, holding the page to the light. But she knew that what gnawed at her was only jealousy. Amanda. The baby was strong now, stronger than I was. It had made me into its creature, with swollen breasts and massive belly, over which the skin stretched slick and tight, like the peel around a currant. It demanded all of my body's attention, all of my food, all of my sleep. It exhausted me. I heaped quilts and pillows on the davenport in the front room, and it was all I could do to lumber from my bed in the morning to that spot where I spent most of the day, looking through the glass at the undulating lake, a clean blue space between my tangled nest and the brown, yellow, and red patchwork of the shore. Swimming was out of the question now. Propped uncomfortably in my cocoon against the cold wall, I could see that the deep blue of the water was unnaturally gorgeous. It was slippery and unstable. It was not to be trusted. I tried to read an old newspaper, but my mind wouldn't take in the words. I let the pages slide to the floor in a slovenly heap. Without my energy, the whole place was falling apart. The garden had gone to seed. The squash and potatoes and onions were buried in weeds. The little room where Ruth slept was strewn with sticks, colored leaves, rocks, and even seaweed, as if the outside had moved in. With the advent of cold weather, spiders had crept in, too, and Ruth seemed always to be crouched in some corner, poking at a daddy longlegs with her fingertip. "Ruth, stop that," I said, seeing she was at it now. "Here, let's wash your face." I hefted myself off the davenport and tromped heavily into the kitchen. Ruth pitter-pattered behind. I picked up the dish towel, meaning to wet it at the sink, but it was already damp and crusted with flour in patches. "Oh, Ruth," I sighed, sinking into a chair. "What have we come to?"
"Outside," she said. "Want to go outside?"
"All right, let me button your sweater." I kissed her forehead and opened the back door for her. "Be careful. Don't go near the water." I kept an eye on her from the window and moved desultorily around the kitchen, trying to make sense of the mess we'd let accumulate there. "Maddie?" I called once, just looking for company. But then I remembered she'd gone to the farm. I picked up a pile of books and papers she'd let drift into a heap on the counter. Really, reading material did not belong in the kitchen. I carried it into the front room, but all the surfaces there were already covered, so I took my load to Matilda's room and dumped it on her unmade bed. This way, at least, she would have to take care of it before she went to sleep. I glanced out the window then for Ruth. I didn't see her in the back. I looked out the side window, searching the garden up and down for her red sweater. Nothing. I hurried to the front. There she was, standing on some rocks and leaning over the water. I opened the door and yelled, "Ruth, come back here!" But she didn't budge, didn't even seem to hear me. Despite my unwieldy body, I was down at the shore before I was even aware that I'd left the porch. If she'd been falling in, I'd probably have caught her before she hit the water, but she wasn't falling in. She was just stirring the lake, making whirlpools with a long stick. The rocks were pleasantly warm in the sun, although the air was chilly, and I sat down next to her, every so often wrapping one arm around her leg to steady my nerves. The water rose and fell between the rocks. I couldn't take my eyes off the ebb and flow, until I noticed the bit of white. It was stuck between two rocks and had not yet slipped far enough for the water to drag it away. I reached for it, but my fingers wouldn't fit. "Here, Ruth, let me borrow your stick a moment." Wedging the stick between the rocks, I managed to work the white paper out far enough to pinch it up. It was an envelope addressed to Carl. Matilda must have dropped it when she was getting into the boat. Of course, I knew what I ought to do, and 7 months ago I would have given it, unopened, to Maddie upon her return. But now I was different. Now I was tempted. Now I had to know what Maddie had written about me. Why should I give it back to her? If I hadn't happened to find it, it would have been lost forever. Maybe I was meant to find it, I told myself. That's the way I thought in those months. Maybe it was waiting here for me. In a way, I'd made myself forget about Carl. After all, far away as he was, and likely to be killed, he had very little to do with us. What I'd imagined when I thought of Maddie raising my baby was something very much like what we were doing now, except with 4 instead of 3. My baby would be both mine and Maddie's, just as Ruth was now Maddie's and mine. In the family I'd envisioned, there was no place for Carl, for squeaking bedsprings, for private smiles, for suppers with applesauce instead of rhubarb, to please a man who had to have everything sweet. But Maddie clearly did not feel as I did. In the letter she told him everything, everything I'd done, everything we'd planned. I was shocked. I saw myself there on the page, the facts of my foolishness and my shame in Maddie's sloppy black letters. I couldn't stand to look at it. And I couldn't stand for him to see it, Carl with his talk of horses and his smooth dance steps and his birdhouse. I didn't want him to have any part of it. In the letter, too, I could see that with him she was not herself. That was almost the worst of it. On the pages she'd meant for him, her voice seemed different from the one I knew. Not only in the things she'd meant to keep private, that I wouldn't have minded so much, but in her everyday observations as well. I could hardly catch a hint of my Mattie in that letter. And when she and he were together, I could see it clearly now, my Mattie would be gone, and there would be no place for me. For the moment, though, I could still keep him out of it. And then, well, the longer he was away, the better chance that he'd never come back. "Ruthie, find me a nice rock, about this big," I said, balling her little hand into a fist. When she brought me the rock, I crumpled the letter around it and heaved it as far as I could. The water gulped, and it was gone. "That was a good one," Ruthie said. "Do it again. It's time for your nap." That night at supper, Ruth announced to her mother, "Aunt Mandy threw a letter, and it went plop." "A letter? You mean a rock, don't you, Ruthie?" Mattie said. Ruth looked at me. "Yes, Ruthie," I said. "Remember, it was a rock, like this." And I wrapped my hand around her fist and squeezed, not too hard, but hard enough to show her that I meant it. Amanda's pulse was racing by 5:30 a.m., and the air, emerging shivery and wet from its bath in the early autumn night, made her hurry still faster. Quickly, she milked the 5 cows and fed the few other animals she and Ruth still kept. With Carl so often away and Rudy aging, and prices the way they were, the fields lay fallow, except for the 2 she'd rented to Joe Tully. She'd pass him somewhere along the way, if she went up the road toward town, but she wasn't going into town. Instead, she slipped a piece of coffee cake into her pocket and took the path into the woods. Ever since she discovered that Imogene was working for Teresa Owens, Amanda had begun to watch the Owens' house as often as she could. Each morning, so far, she'd seen the same thing. Clement in a French blue robe, presumably terry cloth, angling down the slope of his green lawn toward his charming boathouse, a chalet with gingerbread hanging from the roofline, and pink ivy geraniums spilling from the window boxes. He was handsome still, if anything more so, at least through the binoculars. His walk was confident, but less swaggering. His movements, more tentative than they'd once been, appeared thoughtful. Languorously, he walked across the sand under the chalet's porch and onto the pier, jouncing a bit to test its firmness, making sure nothing had slipped or warped during the night. 3/4 of the way to the end, he shucked off his robe and let it drop in a heap at his feet. He didn't dive, as Amanda expected, but sat on the edge of the pier, first dangling his feet in the water and then easing his body in, as if lowering himself into a bath. His strokes were sinuous but weary, his arms lifting in slow arcs and then seeming almost to drop into the water again. For 20 yards he pushed forward and then disappeared beneath the water. When he emerged, he was turned to crawl back. He swam this length twice and then stopped, holding on to the edge of the pier. After a minute or two, he hauled himself out. He shrugged back into his robe without drying himself, and she saw him take from the pocket a little box, open it, and transfer something from it to his tongue, before he stretched out flat under the warming sun, his hands crossed on his chest, so that he looked like a man in his coffin. At 9, Imogene appeared, picking her way down the drive, which was so steep she had to set her feet from toe to heel, and then taking the stairs to the porch with a running step that made her skirt bounce. She lingered a moment at the top, turning to face the lake and standing with one hand on the nearest pillar, as if planting a flag to claim the view for herself. Then she crossed the porch, stood in front of the towering door, and finally disappeared into the great white-pillared maw that was the Owens' house. But today, after a minute or two, the door reopened, and Imogene was once again on the porch. She trotted back down the stairs and continued down the hill toward the lake. Amanda slid onto the floor of her rowboat, ducking her head below the gunwale, praying she was too far away for Imogene to recognize, but the girl paid no attention to the water or anything on it. Instead, she sat neatly on her heels beside a stand of tiger lilies and began to cut them. "Doesn't that woman know they won't keep?" Amanda thought indignantly, but the picking of wildflowers disturbed her far less than what happened next. She'd not even noticed Clement rising, but he was standing now. No, he was already moving, draping the blue robe over his sun-brown skin as he quickly covered the distance to the beach. "Run, Imogene, run!" Amanda found herself whispering from her ridiculous position on the floor of the boat. He was close to the girl now. Amanda could hear in her mind the voice, smooth as expensive whiskey, and the courtly inflection of his words as he asked if he might carry her flowers. She saw him extend his hand, and then she saw Imogene take it and rise from the arcing green leaves. He invited her to walk, ushering her the way he wished her to go, with one hand caressing the air just behind her back. Amanda knew how it was, understood exactly what was happening, even from where she lay with the binoculars pressed so tightly to her eyes that for some seconds she could see only red. Imogene and Clement climbed the hill, enjoying their time together, laughing, turning to face one another. At the foot of the stairs he laid the flowers in her arms, and they parted, he to go right toward the kitchen, she to go up to the main entrance, but he stopped after taking one step. He turned and followed her with his eyes, watching the way her skirt swung around her knees.